You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the August 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. I was devastated. The man who invented the World Wide Web has some regrets. Tim Berners-Lee has seen his creation debased by everything from fake news to mass surveillance, and now he's got a plan to fix it. By Katrina Brooker. Opening photograph by Olaf Blecker. Tim Berners-Lee photographed in Amsterdam. For people who want to make sure the web serves humanity, we have to concern ourselves with what people are building on top of it, Tim Berners-Lee told me one morning in downtown Washington, D.C., about a half mile from the White House. Berners-Lee was speaking about the future of the Internet, as he does often and fervently and with great animation at a remarkable cadence. With an Oxonian wisp of hair framing his chiseled face, Berners-Lee appears the consummate academic, communicating rapidly in a clipped London accent, occasionally skipping over words and eliding sentences as he stammers to convey a thought. His soliloquy was a mixture of excitement with traces of melancholy. Nearly three decades earlier, Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web. On this morning, he had come to Washington as part of his mission to save it. At 63, Berners-Lee has thus far had a career more or less divided into two phases. In the first, he attended Oxford, worked at the European Organization for Nuclear Research, or CERN, and then, in 1989, came up with the idea that eventually became the web. Initially, Berners-Lee's innovation was intended to help scientists share data across a then-obscure platform called the Internet, a version of which the U.S. government had been using since the 1960s. But owing to his decision to release the source code for free, to make the web an open and democratic platform for all, his brainchild quickly took on a life of its own. Berners-Lee's life changed irrevocably, too. He would be named one of the 20th century's most important figures by Time, receive the Turing Award, named after the famed codebreaker, for achievements in the computer sciences, and be honored at the Olympics. He has been knighted by the Queen. He is the Martin Luther King of our new digital world, says Darren Walker, president of the Ford Foundation. Berners-Lee sits on the Foundation's Board of Trustees. Berners-Lee, who never directly profited off his invention, has also spent most of his life trying to guard it. While Silicon Valley started rideshare apps and social media networks without profoundly considering the consequences, Berners-Lee has spent the past three decades thinking about little else. From the beginning, in fact, Berners-Lee understood how the epic power of the web would radically transform governments, businesses, societies. He also envisioned that his invention could, in the wrong hands, become a destroyer of worlds, as Robert Oppenheimer once famously observed of his own creation. His prophecy came to life, most recently when revelations emerged that Russian hackers interfered with the 2016 presidential election, or when Facebook admitted it exposed data on more than 80 million users to a political research firm, Cambridge Analytica, which worked for Donald Trump's campaign. This episode was the latest in an increasingly chilling narrative. In 2012, Facebook conducted secret psychological experiments on nearly 700,000 users. Both Google and Amazon have filed patent applications for devices designed to listen for mood shifts and emotions in the human voice. For the man who set all this in motion, the mushroom cloud was unfolding before his very eyes. "I was devastated," Berners-Lee told me that morning in Washington, blocks from the White House. For a brief moment, as he recalled his reaction to the web's recent abuses, Berners-Lee quieted. He was virtually sorrowful. "Actually, physically, my mind and body were in a different state." Then he went on to recount, at a staccato pace and in elliptical passages, the pain in watching his creation so distorted. This agony, however, has had a profound effect on Berners-Lee. He is now embarking on a third act, determined to fight back through both his celebrity status and, notably, his skill as a coder. In particular, Berners-Lee has, for some time, been working on a new software, Solid, to reclaim the web from corporations and return it to its democratic roots. On this winter day, he had come to Washington to attend the annual meeting of the World Wide Web Foundation, which he started in 2009 to protect human rights across the digital landscape. For Berners-Lee, this mission is critical to a fast-approaching future. Sometime this November, he estimates, half the world's population, close to 4 billion people, will be connected online, sharing everything from resumes to political views to DNA information. As billions more come online, they will feed trillions of additional bits of information into the web, making it more powerful, more valuable, and potentially more dangerous than ever. We demonstrated that the web had failed instead of served humanity as it was supposed to have done, and failed in many places, he told me. The increasing centralization of the web, he says, has ended up producing, with no deliberate action of the people who designed the platform, a large-scale emergent phenomenon which is anti-human. The original idea for the web was born in the early 1960s when Berners-Lee was growing up in London. His parents, both pioneers of the computer age, helped create the first commercial stored program electronic computer. They raised their son on tales of bits and processors and the power of machines. One of his earliest memories is a conversation with his father about how computers would one day function like the human brain. As a student at Oxford in the early 1970s, Berners-Lee built his own computer using an old television and a soldering iron. He graduated with a first-class degree in physics without any particular plans for his future. He subsequently landed a series of jobs at different companies as a programmer, but none of them lasted long. It wasn't until the early 1980s, when he got a consulting position at CERN near Geneva, that his life began to change. He worked on a program to help nuclear scientists share data over another nascent system. At first, Berners-Lee quaintly called it Inquire Within Upon Everything, named after a Victorian-era domestic handbook that he had read as a child. Next photo, Berners-Lee at CERN, outside Geneva, Switzerland, 1994. It would be nearly a decade before Berners-Lee refined the technology, renamed it, and released the web's source code. When it first appeared in an academic chat room in August of 1991, the significance of the moment wasn't immediately obvious. No one paid much attention, recalls Vinton Cerf, who is recognized as being a co-inventor of the Internet, atop which the web sits, and is now chief Internet evangelist at Google. It was an information system that used an older software known as hypertext to link to data and documents over the Internet. There were other information systems at the time. What made the web powerful and ultimately dominant, however, would also one day prove to be its greatest vulnerability. Berners-Lee gave it away for free. Anyone with a computer and an Internet connection could not only access it, but also build off it. Berners-Lee understood that the web needed to be unfettered by patents, fees, royalties, or any other controls in order to thrive. This way, millions of innovators could design their own products to take advantage of it. And, of course, millions did. Computer scientists and academics picked it up first, building applications that then drew others. Within a year of the web's release, nascent developers were already conceiving of ways to draw more and more users. From browsers to blogs to e-commerce sites, the web's ecosystem exploded. In the beginning, it was truly open, free, controlled by no one company or group. "We were in that first phase of what the Internet could do," recalls Brewster Kahle, an early Internet pioneer who in 1996 built the original system for Alexa, later acquired by Amazon. Tim and Vint made the system so that there could be many players that didn't have an advantage over each other. Berners-Lee, too, remembers the quixotism of the era. The spirit there was very decentralized. The individual was incredibly empowered. It was all based on there being no central authority that you had to go to ask permission, he said. That feeling of individual control, that empowerment, is something we've lost. The power of the web wasn't taken or stolen. We, collectively, by the billions, gave it away with every signed user agreement and intimate moment shared with technology. Facebook, Google, and Amazon now monopolize almost everything that happens online. From what we buy, to the news we read, to who we like. Along with a handful of powerful government agencies, they are able to monitor, manipulate, and spy in once unimaginable ways. Shortly after the 2016 election, Berners-Lee felt something had to change and began methodically attempting to hack his creation. Last fall, the World Wide Web Foundation funded research to examine how Facebook's algorithms control the news and information users receive. Looking at the ways algorithms are feeding people news and looking at accountability for the algorithms, all of that is really important for the open web, he explained. By understanding these dangers, he hopes we can collectively stop being deceived by the machine just as half the Earth's population is on board. Crossing 50% is going to be a moment to pause and think, says Berners-Lee, referring to the coming milestone. As billions more connect to the web, he feels an increasing urgency to resolve its problems. For him, this is about not just those already online, but also the billions still unconnected. How much weaker and more marginalized will they become as the rest of the world leaves them behind? We were now talking in a small, nondescript conference room, but Berners-Lee nevertheless felt called to action. Talking about this milestone, he grabbed a notebook and pen and started scribbling, slashing lines and dots and arrows across the page. He was mapping out a social graph of the computing power of the world. "This is maybe Elon Musk when he is using his most powerful computer," said Berners-Lee, drawing a dark line at the top right of the page to illustrate the dominant position of the CEO of SpaceX and Tesla. Lower on the page, he scratched another mark. These are the people in Ethiopia who have reasonable connectivity, but they are totally being spied on. The web, which he had intended as a radical tool for democracy, was merely exacerbating the challenges of global inequality. When about a fifth of the page was covered with lines and dots and scribbles, Berners-Lee stopped. Pointing to the space he'd left untouched, he said, "The goal is to fill in that square, to fill it up so all of humanity has total power on the web." His expression was intent, focused, as though he was calculating a problem for which he did not yet have the solution. "I dumped a little code I had for doing things with email messages," Berners-Lee typed one afternoon this spring, as he posted some code in a chat room on Jitter, an open platform frequented by coders to collaborate on ideas. It was a few days before Mark Zuckerberg was set to testify before Congress, and in this obscure part of the web, Berners-Lee was busy working on a plan to make that testimony moot. The idea is simple. Re-decentralize the web. Working with a small team of developers, he spends most of his time now on Solid, a platform designed to give individuals, rather than corporations, control of their own data. There are people working in the lab trying to imagine how the web could be different, how society on the web could look different, what could happen if we give people privacy and we give people control of their data, Berners-Lee told me. We are building a whole ecosystem. For now, the Solid technology is still new and not ready for the masses. But the vision, if it works, could radically change the existing power dynamics of the web. The system aims to give users a platform by which they can control access to the data and content they generate on the web. This way, users can choose how that data gets used, rather than, say, Facebook and Google doing with it as they please. Solid's code and technology is open to all. Anyone with access to the Internet can come into its chat room and start coding. One person turns up every few days. Some of them have heard about the promise of Solid, and they are driven to turn the world upside down, he says. Part of the draw is working with an icon. For a computer scientist, coding with Berners-Lee is like playing guitar with Keith Richards. But more than just working with the inventor of the web, these coders come because they want to join the cause. These are digital idealists, subversives, revolutionaries, and anyone else who wants to fight the centralization of the web. For his part, working on Solid brings Berners-Lee back to the web's early days. It's under the radar, but working on it in a way puts back some of the optimism and excitement that the fake news takes out. It's still the early days for Solid, but Berners-Lee is moving fast. Those who work closely with him say he has thrown himself into the project with the same vigor and determination he employed upon the web's inception. Popular sentiment also appears to facilitate his time frame. In India, a group of activists successfully blocked Facebook from implementing a new service that would have effectively controlled access to the web for huge swaths of the country's population. In Germany, one young coder built a decentralized version of Twitter called Mastodon. In France, another group created PeerTube as a decentralized alternative to YouTube. "I resent the control corporations have over people and their everyday lives. I hate the surveillance society we have accidentally brought upon ourselves," says Amy Guy, a coder from Scotland, who helped build a platform called ActivityPub to connect decentralized websites. This summer, web activists plan to convene at the second Decentralized Web Summit in San Francisco. Berners-Lee is not the leader of this revolution. By definition, The decentralized web shouldn't have one, but he is a powerful weapon in the fight. And he fully recognizes that re-decentralizing the web is going to be a lot harder than inventing it was in the first place. When the web was created, there was nobody there. No vested parties who would resist, says Brad Burnham, a partner at Union Square Ventures, the renowned venture capital firm, which has started investing in companies aiming to decentralize the web. There are entrenched and very wealthy interests who benefit from keeping the balance of control in their favor. Billions of dollars are at stake here. Amazon, Google, and Facebook won't give up their profits without a fight. In the first 3 months of 2018, even as its CEO was apologizing for leaking user data, Facebook made $11.97 billion. Google made $31 billion. For now, chastened by bad press and public outrage, tech behemoths and other corporations say they are willing to make changes to ensure privacy and protect their users. "I'm committed to getting this right," Facebook's Zuckerberg told Congress in April. Google recently rolled out new privacy features to Gmail, which would allow users to control how their messages get forwarded, copied, downloaded, or printed. And as revelations of spying, manipulation, and other abuses emerge, more governments are pushing for change. Last year, the European Union fined Google $2.7 billion for manipulating online shopping markets. This year, new regulations will require it and other tech companies to ask for users' consent for their data. Now, a chart. How the web was lost. Hacks, viruses, leaks, and surveillance have been part of online life since the beginning. 1971, the world's first computer worm, the creeper, is created. 1981, Ian Murphy becomes the first American convicted of a cybercrime after hacking into AT&T's system to give customers discounted calling rates. 1982-83, a teenage cyber gang who refer to themselves as the 414s hack into the Los Alamos National Laboratory and Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. 1996, hackers break into websites for the United States Department of Justice, the CIA, and the U.S. Air Force. 2001, President Bush signs an order initiating the NSA's domestic spying program. 2006, as part of its newsfeed launch, Facebook posts personal details of users. 2009, in a speech, Berners-Lee warns that the power of online information is so great that the commercial incentive for companies or individuals to misuse it will be huge. 2013, Google acknowledges that Street View, its photo mapping program, used its technology to collect data from home networks without people's knowledge. 2014, the New York Times reports that the NSA is using facial recognition software to store the images of millions of people. 2016, BuzzFeed News uncovers at least 140 fake political news sites designed to generate shares on Facebook by using false information, such as a claim that the Pope endorsed Trump for president. 2017, Facebook acknowledges that Cambridge Analytica collected data on more than 80 million users. In the U.S., Congress and regulators are mulling ways to check the powers of Facebook and others. But laws written now don't anticipate future technologies. Nor do lawmakers, many badgered by corporate lobbyists, always choose to protect individual rights. In December, lobbyists for telecom companies pushed the Federal Communications Commission to roll back net neutrality rules, which protect equal access to the Internet. In January, the U.S. Senate voted to advance a bill that would allow the National Security Agency to continue its mass online surveillance program. Google's lobbyists are now working to modify rules on how companies can gather and store biometric data, such as fingerprints, iris scans, and facial recognition images. The forces that Berners-Lee unleashed nearly three decades ago are accelerating, moving in ways no one can fully predict. And now, as half the world joins the web, we are at a societal inflection point. Are we headed toward an Orwellian future where a handful of corporations monitor and control our lives? Or are we on the verge of creating a better version of society online, one where the free flow of ideas and information helps cure disease, expose corruption, reverse injustices? It's hard to believe that anyone, even Zuckerberg, wants the 1984 version. He didn't found Facebook to manipulate elections. Jack Dorsey and the other Twitter founders didn't intend to give Donald Trump a digital bullhorn. And this is what makes Berners-Lee believe that this battle over our digital future can be won. As public outrage grows over the centralization of the web, and as enlarging numbers of coders join the effort to decentralize it, he has visions of the rest of us rising up and joining him. This spring, he issued a call to arms of sorts to the digital public. In an open letter published on his foundation's website, he wrote, "While the problems facing the web are complex and large, I think we should see them as bugs. Problems with existing code and software systems that have been created by people and can be fixed by people." When asked what ordinary people can do, Berners-Lee replied, "You don't have to have any coding skills. You just have to have a heart to decide enough is enough. Get out your magic marker and your signboard and your broomstick and go out on the streets." In other words, it's time to rise against the machines. brutal landscapes. For years, men had been disappearing without a trace from Toronto's gay village. By the time authorities arrested a 66-year-old landscaper for the murders, the truest horror might have been how easily he had operated among them. By Xander Sherman. Illustrations for this article are by Tomer Hanukkah. Opening illustration. Homicide is so rare in Canada that Kathy Grouspier, a 56-year-old single mom, is the country's only full-time forensic anthropologist. And here, she is shown at work on some flower pots in the lab. In January, more than a dozen fiberglass garden planters arrived at the Ontario Forensics Pathology Service, a glassy 660,000-square-foot facility in North Toronto. It was a cold winter, even by Canadian standards, and the 400-pound faux rock containers, destined for installation in the city that spring, were frozen solid. After letting them thaw for a few days, Dr. Kathy Grouspier began conducting X-rays. When she saw that one of them contained a foreign object, she called Detective Sergeant Hank Itzinga, a hulking homicide cop with the Toronto Police Service. Itzinga's team had helped locate the planters at a private residence on a quiet suburban drive in Leaside and shipped them to Grouspier. "I think there's going to be something in these planters," Itzinga remembers Grouspier saying, "but it could just be a chunk of ice. I don't know." He and his team drove to the lab. By then, the containers had been there for 10 days and were starting to emit a foul odor. In the forensic examination bay, the police watched Grouspier saw the planter she had X-rayed in half. She peeled away the sides to reveal a human head, torsos, and limbs. Through dental and fingerprint analyses, Grouspier's team eventually separated 7 sets of remains. It is hard to overstate how shocking the discovery and its coverage in the press have been in a country where homicide is infrequent and serial killers are almost unheard of. In order of quantity, criminal charges in Canada predominantly relate to theft and other behavior that falls under the legal heading of mischief. Destruction of property, for example, or preventing a fellow Canadian from enjoying his or her property. In 2016, there were 611 homicide victims for the entire country. The state of Ohio had 627 that year. The most recent serial murder case involved a 51-year-old nurse who lethally injected several elderly patients with insulin between 2007 and 2016. Homicide is so rare that Grouspier, a 56-year-old single mom, is the country's only full-time forensic anthropologist. But suddenly, newspapers from the New York Post to the Daily Mail were reporting on a series of murders worthy of a Stephen King novel, in which immigrants' entry into Toronto's gay subculture proved their undoing. The frothiest tabloid coverage surrounding the case played up its tenuous connection to the horror author's 1975 short story, The Lawnmower Man. As the winter gave way to spring, investigators continued to sort through their grisly yield. By early June, their case had grown to include 8 victims. 6 of them, Skandaraj Navaratnam, Majid Kahan, Abdul Basir Faisi, Sarush Mahmoudi, Salim Essen, and Kirushna Kumar Kanagaratnam were of Middle Eastern or South Asian descent. Navaratnam was a 40-year-old Sri Lankan Tamil refugee. Kahan was a 58-year-old Afghani man who was married and had a son. Faizi, 42, had been born in Afghanistan but immigrated from Iran and was married and had a family. Mahmoudi, 50, was from Iran and lived with his Sri Lankan wife and stepson. And Asen, 44, was a Turkish citizen. More than half of Toronto's 2.7 million residents identify as a visible minority. Around 15% are South Asian, and 1% come from the Middle East. The city is known for its inclusiveness, but it can still be a challenging place for new Canadian citizens. Nearly all of the men, as well as two other victims, Dean Lisiewicz, 47, and Andrew Kinsman, 49, had disappeared from the Church and Wellesley neighborhood, also known as Toronto's Gay Village, between 2010 and 2017. Though the area's history as an LGBTQ-friendly enclave dates back years, of late, gentrification in the village has driven up the cost of rent, and the area mainly functions now as a meeting place for people who connect online and come into town for drinks. Several of the victims' families have said they didn't know of their loved ones' visits to the village at all, that the men were leading double lives. In November 2012, a month after Cahan's disappearance, the Toronto Police Service convened a task force to find out what had happened. Within a few months, they had uncovered clues to suggest Navaratnam had met with foul play. The leads, which initially pointed to an online cannibalism ring, were dismissed as fantastical and eventually ruled out. But they brought Edzinga, a 30-year police veteran, onto the case. Investigators began by interviewing Navaratnam's friends. According to multiple reports, this included a then-60-year-old landscape designer, Bruce MacArthur. Toronto police refused to confirm whether they spoke with MacArthur at that time. Known as Santa for his seasonal employment at a shopping mall, MacArthur was a twinkle-eyed grandfather who liked tropical birds and hated Donald Trump. Born in rural Ontario in 1951, he graduated from Fenelon Falls Secondary School, married his high school sweetheart, and became a salesman, first at Stanfield's and then at McGregor Socks, both Canadian garment manufacturers. The couple had a son and a daughter, now grown. Around 1998, when he was in his late 40s, MacArthur came out and moved to the village. At 5'10" and 221 pounds, Santa was unassuming in both appearance and demeanor, the type who baked muffins, sipped wine, and lavished friends with roses on their birthdays. "The kindest person I've ever known," is how one of MacArthur's many friends described him, according to police records. The owner and sole proprietor of Artistic Design, a man-in-a-van landscaping business, he was popular with clients, many of them older, wealthy Torontonians, who appreciated MacArthur's love of succulents, especially exotic varieties with thick, fleshy leaves. Police learned MacArthur had employed Navaratnam as a landscaper. The two had also dated on and off for years. MacArthur was interviewed, then let go, and having failed to find any criminal evidence, Project Houston, as the task force was named in 2013, closed down. Mahmoudi, Lisiewicz, Asim, Kinsman, and Kanaragaratnam all vanished over the next 4 years. Next illustration, as Toronto police continued to deny what was obvious to many in the gay village, Hank Edzinga and a small group of detectives quietly launched a new investigation called Project PRISM. By summer 2017, pretty much everyone in the village knew there was a serial killer in their midst. All of these men had gone missing, each with a connection to the neighborhood, most from social groups that were marginalized in one way or another. Even civilians with a glancing knowledge of the typical serial killer profile by now know that many seek out those on the edge of society, people whose disappearances take longer to be noticed, if at all. Sasha Reed, a 29-year-old University of Toronto psychology researcher and PhD candidate who studies the inner worlds of serial killers, told me that marginalized people are easier to dehumanize, less likely to be reported missing, and often live in proximity to their predators. In the 1980s and 1990s, Jeffrey Dahmer infamously operated within the gay community in Milwaukee by using his familiarity with its members and their social landscape to find targets, while also benefiting from the fact that many of his victims had fewer than average connections to society at large. More recently, the suspected serial killer responsible for the deaths of up to 16 female sex workers on New York's Long Island used the relative anonymity of Craigslist to solicit some of his victims. While the Toronto of 2017 was an undeniably more progressive place than the Reagan-era Rust Belt, it still had its share of the kinds of collective isolation that such killers could take advantage of. Next illustration, going on instinct as much as experience, Sasha Reed theorized the killer would be male, have a blue-collar job, and be sexually motivated. In July, Reed was surfing Ontario's missing adult registry and came across three names, Navaratnam, Kahand, and Faizi, that linked to photos of brown-bearded men. Studying serial homicide, you learn to pick up on patterns, Reed told me. That night, Reed put together a profile of a hypothetical killer. Going on instinct as much as experience, she guessed the killer would be male, because almost all are, have a blue-collar job, because almost all do, and be sexually motivated, because the missing men appeared to be of a type, suggesting a preference or erotic fixation. She phoned Toronto police, relaying her profile to an officer who stayed on the line for about half an hour. He revealed that police had received numerous calls about a potential serial killer. Yet, as late as December 2017, 6 months after Kinsman's disappearance, Toronto Police Chief Mark Saunders insisted there was no evidence of a serial killer. As the police continued to deny what seemed obvious to many in the community, Itzinga and a small group of detectives quietly launched a new investigation called Project Prism. By the summer of 2017, they had begun to look more closely at MacArthur, and they didn't have to dig too deep for signs that suggested a history of violence. On October 31, 2001, police arrived at the apartment of a male escort who called 911 after awakening from a blackout. The victim had invited MacArthur into his apartment around noon that day and was considering showing MacArthur his Halloween costume when MacArthur, unprovoked, hit him in the head with a metal pipe that he had brought with him. "I don't know why I did it," MacArthur reportedly said after turning himself in to police. In January 2003, MacArthur pleaded guilty to assault, causing bodily harm. He received a conditional sentence barring him from the village and further contact with escorts. In 2016, MacArthur was investigated for a potential sexual assault, though police set him free without charging him. Itzinga's team learned that MacArthur was once a regular of the Black Eagle, the bar where Andrew Kinsman had worked. MacArthur had both dated Kinsman and employed him at Artistic Design, as he had with Navaratnam. He was also active on gay apps and websites, including Grindr, Scruff, ManJam, and Silver Daddies. He was meeting guys, hooking up with them, employing them, and then, it seemed to cops, disappearing them. In September 2017, a month into Project Prism, MacArthur dumped his work vehicle, a maroon Dodge Caravan, at a scrapyard, taking a cash offer of $150. In October, Police recovered the van and found traces of blood in the trunk. Though no causes of death have been announced, men who went on dates with MacArthur and survived described submissive role play that became violent. Since MacArthur's arrest in January, the village community as a whole has been outraged, grief-stricken, and exhausted. A candlelight vigil was held in February. This June, the normally ebullient Pride Parade was expected to be noticeably more somber, as participants prepared to wear black to honor the victims. With resentment lingering in the gay community, Toronto police withdrew their application to march. Even as the prosecution moves forward, police are still gathering potential evidence against MacArthur. In May, they concluded a 5-month inventory of his apartment and wrapped up searching nearly 100 properties across the city that he had landscaped, including the one where the planters were found. Additionally, they are going back through a catalog of cold cases. Itsinga has said he wouldn't be surprised if MacArthur was charged with other murders, though no direct links have been made, and the number may change, according to the evidence. When I ask Itsinga how he was refining the search, considering some inconsistencies in MacArthur's alleged victims, he said, "Our filters have essentially been blown out of the water. Two were white, and one went missing east of Toronto. What unites the men is their social isolation, or the parts of their lives that they isolated from loved ones." Lisowick was homeless. Kanagaratnam and Navaratnam were refugees. Asen struggled with addiction. Friends told me that Andrew Kinsman, a village community fixture, had demons. Haran Vijayanathan is the executive director of Toronto's Alliance for South Asian AIDS Prevention and was Grand Marshal of Pride 2018. He said that, from the beginning, police treated the disappearance of Kinsman differently from the disappearance of the 7 others. It was like, "You guys took this seriously when it happened to be a white person who went missing, but when the other guys went missing, no one really paid attention." Saunders told me this was unequivocally inaccurate. A spokesman for the Toronto Police Service said that officers spent 18 months on their search for Navaratnam, Faizi, and Kahan, and that their investigation included thousands of hours interviewing dozens of witnesses, multiple judicial authorizations, community canvasses, and online searches. A relatively privileged group of friends and co-workers advocated for Kinsman, postering the neighborhood and creating a website. But when a homeless person goes in to report something, are they going to be taken seriously? Vijayanathan asked me, "If it's someone who's new to the country and can't speak English well, are they going to be treated with respect? Or are they going to be yelled at and treated like they're dumb?" In response to the MacArthur case, Vijayanathan's group has set up a safety program. The disappearance of vulnerable people is reported to police within 48 hours. One day this spring, I drove to Woodville, a farming community 85 miles north of Toronto. Like other Canadians, I'd spent the winter wondering how something like this could have happened here, and whether more horrors lay beneath the still frozen ground. I found MacArthur's old house, a bungalow that sits off a main road on a slight hill. It was just like thousands of other rural homes scattered throughout southern Ontario. The question was what had made MacArthur so different. How had he gone from the clean-cut country boy depicted in his yearbook photos to an accused serial killer? The only person who can really answer that question is MacArthur, if he knows himself. He is reportedly in segregation and on suicide watch at Toronto South Detention Center a maximum security facility west of Toronto, and has yet to enter a plea. The trial, if there is one, won't start until next year. His lawyer declined to comment. In the same Fenelon Falls yearbook, MacArthur had filled out the standard questionnaire. Favorite pastime, debate, ambition in life, to be successful, though he didn't say how. Next to his probable future, he put, "Your guess is as good as mine."
Thank you.
This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.